I'm George Liston, CA.
The history of Russia is written in brick and mortar, wood and stone. Over many centuries, the ties between church and state, the whims of rulers, and the passions of a people have conspired to illuminate and inspire the great chronicles that are Russia's story, and they are revealed in Russia's grand architecture. How this has happened is revealed in William Craft Brumfield's new book, A History of Russian Architecture. And my guest is Bill Brumfield. Welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bill, your book makes a very sustained and really quite elegant, it's a very beautiful book, I think I should say at first, just visually appealing as well as intellectually stimulating. But I felt it made a very sustained case for the influence of religion on Russian architecture, and I got the impression this starts right at the start, right at the establishment of Orthodox Christianity in Kiev under Vladimir and his son Yaroslav. Mm-hmm. Is this true, and how important is this?
Yes, I think that in view of the fact that Byzantine missionaries moved up toward the north, they moved into a forested zone, a zone in which people's habitat had been defined by the forest. People preferred to live in wooden houses, and they continued to, even people of considerable wealth. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the architecture of the church, many of the churches were also of wood, but the lasting monuments, those of stone and brick, were specifically dedicated to religious purposes.
Right.
Therefore, you have, unlike parts of Western Europe where you have castles and the chateau and various other forms of housing for at least the elite, in Russia that has largely vanished because it was built of wood.
Right, exactly.
So for the first several centuries, at least until the 17th century, a history of Russian architecture is largely a history of churches.
Exactly so.
And monasteries.
And powerfully beautiful ones, too, as this book brings out.
Yes.
Another interesting element comes into our story, Bill, as you tell it in your book. Early on, it really fascinated me, and that is, and I know we're making somewhat of a leap here in time and circumstance, but in the later medieval period, the very fact of prosperity enters the picture in a big way, commercial prosperity, and cities like Novgorod and help me with the pronunciation of Pskov.
Pskov, yes.
Yeah. What does that amount to, and what does that additional element bring into the story of Russian architecture?
There are many questions on this matter. Certainly the fact that the Russians or the Novgorodians were trading with Hanseatic ports had an impact on luxury items. It had an impact on the circulation of money. And to that extent, it had an impact on the building of churches. More merchants means more endowments for the construction of brick churches.
Right.
Otherwise, we don't see very much influence.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few cases that would be of interest to specialists, but Russian cities remain as distinctive and different in contrast to northern European trading cities. They remain as different and distinctive after the 16th century as before. We don't seem to get that sort of interaction that overcomes the barriers. Trade notwithstanding, we're still two different universes.
So what trade really does, what prosperity really does, is emphasize this distinction. It doesn't change it.
That's right.
Uh-huh. Now let's keep focusing on this. This is absolutely fascinating. What does church architecture mean in this context? For example, I'm thinking of very specific things. The style in which Russian churches are built, the use of the cupola, the fact that they seem to be, in some of the surrounding context, they look like they're lighter than the buildings you see surrounding them. I mean, what kind of significance should give to physical details like that?
I think the church always was an organizing feature in the city as well as in the country. Mm-hmm. The church signified the presence of the community. Mm-hmm. And in the city, it signified the presence of a particular guild or a group of merchants. Now, bearing in mind that even in cities, many of the churches were of logs, mm-hmm. but it was the masonry churches with their white stucco walls that you were referring to that rose above the surrounding structures. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, they were the strongest buildings around, so that for a merchant town like Novgorod, these very practical patrons of church architecture would also use the bottom part of the church, the basement, if you like, mm-hmm. to store their own goods. Huh. So we know many, many cases of that in which they served as storehouses because they were less likely to be damaged by fire,
right?
Which was the endemic catastrophe for Russian towns, precisely mm-hmm. because they were built of logs. Logs are not a material that burns easy, but once mm-hmm. it gets started, you can say goodbye to the whole thing.
You know, I'm struck again, though, Bill, as you speak, by the centrality of religious power and religious influence in the architectural design of mm-hmm. the Russian city, and the fact that the commercial interests, which have their own obvious economic power, really seem to, and exposes the question in a sense, accommodate themselves to it.
Yeah,
you know, they find their place within it rather than seeking to change it.
That's true. Although there were suspicions that Novgorod was a seat of heresy, mm-hmm. and Moscow ultimately conquered Novgorod with little bloodshed at the end of the 15th century, and then with horrendous bloodshed during the reign of Ivan the Terrible mm-hmm. in the 1560s and 1570s, in which large parts of the city were simply slaughtered. So this notion that if you're trading, you have multiple allegiances mm-hmm. is something that Muscovy found very suspicious, and ultimately they put an end to it. Novgorod continued to exist, but the great churches are silent sentinels of a free culture, relatively free, mm-hmm. That Muscovy could not tolerate.
You mentioned Muscovy, and that precisely brings me to my next question, in fact, because I think you've just told us about the suspicion, the fear, and ultimately the dislike and suppression that Moscow would direct toward Novgorod and other places. Mm-hmm. But the Muscovite expression of architecture itself, Bill, is interesting, isn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. because here we get a couple of additional factors brought into the discussion, that is to say power itself and mm-hmm. obviously the use of power and what real estate people love to call location, location, location. I mean, how did that influence it?
Nobody understood that better than the Russians. Hmm. Architecture is an expression of power. And as long as the right people were supervising the building, didn't matter where you came from, because the Muscovite princes in the end of the 15th century brought most of their architects from Italy, most of the leading architects. Novgorod also played, and Pskov played a part in the development of Moscow architecture because they had the best masons. Mm-hmm. But the great leap forward in terms of power architecture mm-hmm. occurs when the Muscovite princes, specifically Ivan III, known as Ivan the Great, when they began to invite Italians. Let's cut to the chase. We don't want to use the homegrown product. Let's go to the best builders in Europe, and those were in Italy. Mm. Now, there was a very interesting and complicated set of historical factors that led Russians to hire Italians. We won't go into that right now. The important thing is that they hired them. They were unmistakable in their own sense of purpose. Architecture is an expression of our identity, mm-hmm. of our centralized power, and all of that is in praise of Moscow.
Bill, to keep our story running in the same chronological vein that the book depicts and that you've been helping us with, and you mentioned earlier, just in passing, Ivan the Terrible and all of that, and the time of troubles. And what is that? What's the effect of that period in time and his influence on the continuity of our story? Does it change it?
No, quite the contrary. I think it's an essential element in the continuity because those churches and those monasteries became the almost the sole surviving elements mm-hmm. of Russian Muscovite culture at a time when it seemed as though Muscovy might disappear from the map in the beginning of the 17th century. So severe were its problems, dynastic, military, social, There were so many dysfunctional aspects of the Muscovite state at the beginning of the 17th century during the Time of Troubles, which lasts until the late teens. The Romanov dynasty is established in 1613, but the Time of Troubles actually continues beyond that. The Swedes are still there. The Poles still occupy much of the country. So I think in the terms of galvanizing the national resistance, the church as an institution and the church as a physical artifact was a major source in defending that realm, which was on the point of fragmenting. A number of monasteries participated in heroic defenses, not just against the Poles, but against other elements in society that wanted to destroy the Muscovite structure.
Right.
And so that architecture became a beacon. And I should say, by the way, that the Russian architecture is very well suited to that purpose because it's highly centralized and vertical.
Bill, let me take just a moment from our conversation to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is William Brumfield, author of A History of Russian Architecture and also professor of Slavic Studies at Tulane University. Moving ahead, as we love to say in broadcasting, Bill, coming to Peter I, there seems to be, and this is shorthand, obviously, but an acceleration of the inclusion of Western forms and Western influence. Obviously, that's a very kind of generalized statement. I want you to refine it for us. But he's the one who moves the capital, as I understand it, from Moscow to St. Petersburg. He's the one who has a great admiration for the architecture he's seen in places like England and Holland. So the question is, what does all that amount to? What does he do with that that move of the capital and that influence of the outside architectural forms?
Well, he wants to recast the cultural template. Now Russia is going to be a country that can compete and associate with the great European powers. That means being able to dress like them, behave like them, write like them, listen to their music, paint as they paint. Create a new secular society in which the church is a functioning part, not an autonomous institution. And to signal that overwhelming transformation, the church is also expected to adhere to the new European architectural forms that Peter was importing from countries such as Denmark, even Sweden, his age-old foe. All of these northern European countries provided models for secular and sacred architecture. He was determined to recast it. One of the reasons for leaving Moscow behind was to have an open field, quite literally, as well as metaphorically, have an open field for a new statement of national identity, Russia as a major player in European power politics.
And therefore a more westernized Russia. And
had to be.
And a Russia in which the church was had something of a lesser status?
Had to be. That the church was one part of, as the Germans called it, the well-ordered state. Which all of the parts would interrelate as a mechanism. No longer would you hold off the West behind the bulwarks of your Kremlins. Many Russian cities had a Kremlin, by the way. It just refers to a fortified citadel. No longer would you retreat behind the walls. You would aggressively go out. Fight if you need to. But you would do that on the terms of your competitors. And architecture, again, has a critical role in establishing that thrust.
Two questions, Bill, that inspired right at this moment by what you've just said. The first is how successful he was in terms, I'm thinking here in terms of the reaction within Russia to this this attempt to do this through architecture and other means. And then secondly, just physically, if you give us a sense of Petersburg as a kind of his laboratory for this architecturally. I mean, how is it reflected? What is the most striking about that entire attempt?
Well, what it's great cost is the first thing that we think about. The enormous human effort and sacrifice that was required to build that city on an extremely inhospitable marsh, deltaic marsh, where the Neva flows into the Gulf of Finland. It changed power politics in Europe, one might say forever. Peter the Great, by putting a city there, changed the vector
of strategic politics in Northern Europe, one could say in Europe generally. Petersburg did that by decree during his reign. But the city took shape very, very painfully during the reign of Peter and his immediate successors. Mm-hmm. Like only in the 1740s do you really find it taking root. Because remember, every building there was built on mud, so it had to be, the foundation had to be driven for every building, oak pilings. And that was, of course, in those days by simply brute force,
right,
where people, serfs, workers would manhandle the driving head up by means of a rope and pulley system and then let it fall. So thousands and thousands of pilings had to be used to create even the basis for, right, for these buildings.
Catherine the Great, the note I took on her, Bill, reading in the chapter, was that here is someone who saw the ability of architecture to reflect glory. It seemed to really motivate her, and that her, at least one of her expressions of this, maybe the most dominant, was neoclassicism that she brought in. Is that correct?
Yes.
And to what extent, to what purpose?
There's a curious, I would almost say opposition here, because yes, architecture reflects glory, but architecture itself should be rational, should be restrained, should be the project of logic and reason. So that you have to, many people, a rather uninspiring architecture based on Palladian principles and whatnot. But when you get into the details, you see how exquisitely proportioned it is. But it doesn't immediately come out and proclaim the power that we've spoken of in terms of the Kremlin. Or in other times of Russian culture. It is a very elegant, I would say sophisticated, form of balance. So that Catherinian architecture perhaps shows itself best in the imperial estates outside of Petersburg, right, where it has the landscape, where the English park that Catherine so admired comes into play. It's architecture in its natural setting. But the notion is that architecture, like all human endeavor, has to be controlled.
Right.
None of this Baroque fancy that one has in the palaces of Rastrelli.
Yeah.
There has to be an order there that reflects the clarity of a well-ordered mind.
And does this emphasis on the well-ordered mind's expression through architecture continue with Tsar Alexander?
Yes, I'd say it probably reaches its apogee in Alexander's reign. The imperial masters were remarkably gifted in finding talent. Didn't matter from what social stratum. They had a way of recognizing and promoting gifted architects. Now, true, they still continued to bring people from France and Italy and other places, but Russian architects of that period are among the best in Europe.
It seems to me, and I fully agree, this is what I've learned from the book, that obviously you're quite right about that, and two additional things perhaps helped Alexander. The first is this ability to recognize talent, to bring it in, to put it to work. Also, the population of St. Petersburg itself is growing vastly under his reign.
Yeah.
And then he has, in a bureaucratic sense, a planning commission.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's right.
That administratively works very well.
That's right. And Catherine laid the foundations for much of that, but Alexander was perhaps the primary beneficiary. That doesn't mean he determined and controlled every aspect of it, but he was, let's say, extremely fortunate in the talent and genius of the people who worked under his reign. And that continued to the first part of Nicholas I reign.
Yeah.
But there you already have, as you know from the book, a turning toward technology. A loss of the sense of the elegant classical statement, and perhaps elsewhere in Europe as well. People got tired of classicism.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You know, and moving into the 19th century and thinking of the changes that are undergoing, here's something that occurs to me, that the 19th century, to speak of that at this point in our conversation, one word comes to me, Bill, and I don't know if it's an apt word or not, but search. It seems to me that there's this progression of trying the Gothic renewal, trying this and that, but all to the purpose of coming up for, and I think this phrase appears in the book, a unifying ideal. Is that, I mean, they seem to be trying things, trying things. Is that
Yes, and never quite finding that unifying ideal, which is why at the beginning of the 20th century, some architects in Russia, as in Britain, went back to the classical ideal. But you're quite right. The period you're talking about is usually known as eclecticism or historicism. Mm-hmm. Eclecticism simply means the architecture of choice. Mm-hmm. You choose the style. And architecture students were trained that way. Right. It's also a factor of what they were trained in architectural schools. So the one interesting thing about classicism, though, we should go back and point this out. Vincent Scully, in a review of an earlier one of my books, was amazed when he saw some of my photographs from Katharinian Russia and said, "This is what Jefferson was doing." Of the classical vocabulary in architecture, whether it was France, Britain, America, or Russia, is something that we could, I think, do more with.
That's stunning, yeah.
So for a time, although people got bored with it, although people got bored with the unifying idea, as people do, thankfully, for a time it really was a universal language. So that Charlottesville, Monticello, some of the estates of Katharinian Russia, some of the townhouses, these are some of Catherine's own estates. These are part of a general language. People outgrew that, but they never forgot it.
That's a wonderful point, absolutely wonderful point. 20th century. I'm just getting used to calling it the last century, the 20th century. The turn of the 20th century, modernism is big in Europe and here and elsewhere. But there's a Russian expression of it, is there, Bill, or is there not?
Yes, there is. Once we get past the Art Nouveau period and the neoclassical revival, after the First World War, after the Revolution, we have a radical view of form, function. Much of it is motivated by artists. Mm-hmm. It's really artists who define some of the primary agendas in Russian avant-garde architecture. And at this point, Russia, or Soviet Union, as we should call it, becomes one of the most interesting places in Europe in terms of architectural experimentation. People are now suddenly looking to the Russians. Partly because they're trying to create a new socialist society, but also because the architecture is fascinating. Now, much of it remained on paper. It's ironic that, or perhaps entirely appropriate, that the architects were designing these very forward, advanced projects, some of which are very relevant to this day. And at the same time had no means to realize them other than bricks and mortar, which they've been using for the past two centuries. So it's the paper that gave the spirit of the ideal. Of the design. When we see these buildings that were built in the 1920s, they're often in terrible condition today, but you can still see what the architect's project was. But it's best seen in these visionary designs, and they moved all of Europe, including the Bauhaus. And
I didn't know that. Yeah, I really didn't. Yeah. There was that much talent and that much, and you know, even that which remained on paper was exciting. Some of that, of course, got transformed into. And the question, of course, is because now, as you said, we're talking about Soviet Russia here, and the revolution. And I guess the question then, Bill, is: did all of that, or did much of that, at least in the government's eyes, have the purpose of, quote, giving a physical expression to new social ideas? I mean, was that to be all of a piece with the philosophy of the communist state?
Well, that's what it was supposed to do. A new society expressed by a new architecture. In Stalinist period, though, things become a little more complicated. There, the expression of power reasserts itself. Power is expressed in traditional ways. So you have something of an attack on the avant-garde. This is not by any means a step-by-step linear process. There are digressions, there are exceptions, so that it's difficult to establish an absolute process from one to the other. Nonetheless, clearly the avant-garde fell out of favor. Historicist projections of power became the norm during the Stalinist period. In some cases, they go back to the Italian Renaissance. In some cases, Petersburg neoclassicism. In some cases, Moscow Kremlin. But architecture, even if it had a steel frame, was still supposed to project that notion of continuity.
Right.
The new power is the heir to the old. Even if we've overthrown the old values, we're still a centralized, ordered state. Right. And architecture must proclaim that. But then, of course, you have the social imperative, create housing for workers. You also have the largely unnoticed history of the use of slave labor in many of these projects, including some very notable buildings in Moscow,
right?
Particularly during the Stalinist period.
Well, Bill, as we come to the conclusion of another delightful conversation I've had with you, and I obviously feel very, very strongly about the wonders of this book and recommend it to all, I'm reminded of another book, and this is my closing question to you. It's one that Jim Billington wrote recently called Russia in Search of Itself, which is about the identity search in the post-communist era. And as I read your book, it struck me that this identity search has really been one of the great contributions of Russian architecture over history. At least I have a sense that Russian architecture has historically been a signifier of the evolution of that identity, and I just wanted to get your comment on that.
It has, but I think it's time to go beyond the national identity question. I think that's used more often than it need be in terms of contemporary Russian architecture. Much of contemporary Russian architecture is simply kitsch. And there are references to neo-neo styles as though that validated anything. I think the true essence of a national culture is not just how they're able to repackage their past, but what they can create that is viable and beautiful in terms of the present. And there are examples of this, and they're not very well known in Moscow today, and there are not very many of them.
Well, you're saying this is not a dead issue or a static issue. Creativity is essential.
Absolutely, that's at the center of it. And you'll always find the national crux in creativity. I mean, where else does it come from? So you don't need to look back to questions of national identity plays an important role in some eras, more important in some than in others. But ultimately, defining it in a strictly self-referential way is self-defeating.
It strikes me as words of wisdom, Bill Brumfield. it's been a great pleasure, Bill. Once again, the book is A History of Russian Architecture. And as I said earlier, it's a handsome volume as well as a richly rewarding one. Thank you for being our guest today.
You're quite welcome.
You've been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was William Brumfield, author of A History of Russian Architecture. I'm George Listencia, producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber, and our assistant producer is Sharana Ward.